Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim. Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining us for our podcast this week. My name is Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Each week, we interview leaders and they share lessons learned from their careers. Our goal is to help you become a better leader. This week, we're going to revisit a conversation that we had a while back with Vanessa Bonds. We're going to be discussing her book, You Have More Influence Than You Think. She is a social psychologist and award-winning researcher and teacher and professor of organizational behavior at Cornell University. Her writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Harvard Business Review, and looking forward to today's conversation with Vanessa. Well, I guess, first off, can you give us just a little bit of your career story, a little bit of your background?
Sure. So my background, I think of as very kind of roundabout getting to where I was. Although if you put the pieces together, I think looking back, you can kind of construct a story that's all about a general interest in psychology. If you just went from my undergrad, where I was a major in psychology, to now where I'm a professor of basically psychology and work, it looks like, oh, there's this very direct sort of path. But along the way, I started in advertising. And thought that that was going to be what I was going to do and wound up, you know, not really loving it that much. And then I worked in a sleep lab and loved doing sleep research, but realized that if you do sleep research, you have to stay up late at night. And my body was not designed for that. And then I worked in elder care, which I thought maybe I'd be a clinician of some sort, maybe a clinical psychologist. And then I wound up going back to graduate school and getting into social psychology and social influence. And I'd say kind of looking back at each stage, I talk to my students a lot about this because my students are, you know, between the ages of 18 and 22, they're trying to figure out what they want to do. I'd say looking back, you know, each decision got me closer to where I am now in a very happy place. But at the time, I just felt like I was floundering, you know? And so I'm always telling my students, just take the next step. It's nice to have these plans that are long-term. I mean, those are great. But if you don't have one, just take the next step. And that may help you get to that next step. And then, you know, serendipity can play a role. And all of a sudden, you're starting to see a bigger picture. And then you look back and it's like, oh, now it all makes sense.
So any other advice that you're giving a lot of 20-year-olds, probably some thoughts about life and career and that, but any advice you would, looking back on, knowing what you know now, you would give yourself at the age of 22?
I think the biggest thing is definitely that, you know, at each stage, nothing is forever. We tend to think like, if I take this job, that's it, you know, that's it for my life. But I think there's a lot more flexibility and a lot more movement than we tend to realize when we're sort of looking forward than when we're looking backward. And so I think taking chances, you know, checking things out, exploring a little, not being afraid to take these winding paths is usually what I tell my students. I mean, I think they tend to be very high achieving and, you know, think that they have to have it all planned out and that if they make a misstep, right, that it's undoable or somehow they're going to be set back in their career for life. And so that's usually the advice I'm giving them is to relax a little bit about these smaller steps and treat them that way. And then, you know, see where it takes you.
So you have a book that has come out. It's entitled, You Have More Influence Than You Think. Talk a little bit, just your kind of what led you to this this book and kind of just what were some of the thoughts behind it?
That's right. So, you know, I'm a social psychologist. And when I went to graduate school, and one of my very first projects was working with a professor in the business school at Columbia. I was at Columbia in the psychology department. And we were running a study together. And that study involved me going down to Penn Station and collecting data from people. We wanted sort of everyday people in our experiment. And so I would walk up to people and ask them to fill out a survey in Penn Station, you know, people sitting there waiting for their trains. And it was such a sort of traumatic experience to me, which is kind of funny to say, but it really was. And I think anyone who has asked people for things knows that that fear and that just discomfort of asking. And then, you know, when the study was over, the professor I was working with, Frank Flynn, and I looked at the data, and we were kind of, I was describing to him what the experience had been like and just, you know, kind of joking with him, you know, never make me do that again. That was horrible. And he was kind of looking at the data, and our original hypothesis didn't work out, but he was looking at it and saying, you know, how you're, what you're describing looks so different from the data. You're describing this horrible experience where you were so worried about rejection, but look at the data. Almost everybody was saying yes to you. So many people were participating in this study. And so that's where we got the idea to start looking at social influence, but social influence in a different way than people typically look at it. So people typically look at, you know, how do you get people to do things? How do you get people to say yes? But we were interested in the disconnect between how we imagine influence is going to be and then how it actually turns out to be, and kind of reflecting that experience that I had where I was like, this is going to be awful. You know, people are going to really hate that I'm asking them to do this thing and say no to me, when in fact, people were quite happy to agree. And the experience was much less painful in the end, you know, despite my kind of joking about how awful it was, than I anticipated.
So you, I think it's in the beginning of your book, you talk about this experiment where people go and kind of randomly give people a compliment. And talk a little bit about that experiment and just some of the thoughts or lessons that you learned out of that.
Yeah, I love these experiments that we did. I did them with Erica Boothby, who is a postdoc at Wharton. And as you said, we brought people into the lab and we sent them out into the world and we had them give random people compliments. And what we were looking at was, again, this idea of how we think an interaction is going to go in our head and then how it actually goes. And so we told people, you're going to go give a random compliment to a stranger. In our first study, we wanted to hold the compliment itself constant. And so we said, you're all going to say the same thing. You're going to say, hey, I like your shirt. And we said, how much do you think that the other person is going to enjoy this interaction, feel flattered by your compliment, feel good that you gave them a compliment? And then they went out and did it. And then we gave surveys to the person who was complimented. And we asked them, you know, how good did it feel to get this compliment? How flattered were you? And what we found was that, just like, you know, my experience in Penn Station, people in their heads thought, you know, this interaction is going to be awkward. You know, this is not going to make this person feel that good. But then when we actually looked at the data of the people who were complimented, they said that the compliment made them feel better and more flattered than our participants had anticipated. And they even said that the interaction was less awkward and uncomfortable than our participants anticipated. So they kind of had this idea that I'm going to be bothering these people by interrupting them and giving them a compliment. But people were quite happy, you know, to be interrupted if what they got out of it was a compliment.
There's another section of that where you had people write letters, gratitude letters, which I've heard others talk about just the power of gratitude and how that, but talk a little bit of kind of what the power of your influence can have on others, and just a simple thing that can definitely make an impact.
Yeah. And so this was research that was actually done by Amit Kumar and Nick Eppley, where they had people, as you said, write gratitude letters. So, you know, our compliment study was just simple little compliments. And it's kind of amazing that just, you know, a simple word can make people feel that good and kind of have that impact on people. But their study was a little bit more serious. It was like the people who we really are thankful and grateful to in our lives, who we think about all the time. And I think many of us have this experience, right? Where you just feel intense gratitude for things that people have done for you along the way, but you don't always express it to them. And so what they did is they had people actually write out letters to these people who they felt grateful for in their lives. And they did something similar to what we did. They asked people how they thought the other person would feel receiving these letters. And similarly, again, you know, people thought that these letters would come across kind of awkward. They doubted their ability to clearly and kind of articulately express their gratitude for this other person. But then when they surveyed the other person who received this letter, they were just blown away. They just felt the warmth coming through the letter, and they didn't care if it was, you know, not perfectly articulated. Sure. They're not thinking about those kinds of things. But they really appreciated getting these letters, and it impacted them more than the people thought it would.
So I think we've all had times, and probably because there's so few, that you've gotten a letter or a note that really had an impact, and probably the person that sent it probably doesn't even know what that impact was. But I think that as leaders, and a lot of our listeners are either new or maybe their first time CEOs, and I think they understand the position or the authority part of it as far as of having the title. But talk a little bit more about the influence and impact of leadership as far as on people that that you're called to lead.
Yeah, this is an interesting thing about leadership and power that I talk about quite a bit in the book, is that, you know, when you're put in a leadership position or in a power position, it comes with authority, as you said. It comes with, you know, the way we would describe it is it comes with opportunity. So you have this great opportunity to lead people, to share your vision, to, you know, take your group or your organization in a new direction that you're excited about. But it also comes with necessarily responsibility at the same time, right? And so studies have shown that people tend to think of power and leadership in terms of opportunity, and they tend to downplay the responsibility that comes with it. And so if you even remind people that actually as leader of this group, you're going to have all these responsibilities, like deciding how to allocate resources fairly and doing things like this, that people actually find leadership less appealing when you kind of remind them of that responsibility. And so one of the things I talk about is this fact that, you know, with this opportunity, we also have to be aware of the fact that that great vision we have, that we're taking, you know, the organization in this great new direction, if it doesn't work out, there are people's lives who are attached to that who will be affected, you know, that at the same time, we have this responsibility to other people, to hear them, to let them voice their opinions, and basically to create space for other people and to think about how our decisions impact them.
And a lot of times in an organization, it's not the person with the title that sometimes has the most influence. Sometimes it could be the person at the front desk of a small organization that probably has a lot of influence, as far as, and people don't recognize that. And I think as a new leader coming into an organization, figuring out who has influence, and again, you're in a position where you have the title, but talk a little bit about how to manage that in getting more people involved, even though you might be leading a group.
Yeah, it is. You know, it's fascinating. There's a story that I actually have not told many people before. But when I was in Brazil many years ago, I wound up getting held up at gunpoint, which is a whole other story.
Wow.
And all of my stuff was taken, and my money was gone, my credit cards. I had kind of no way of getting back home. And so my friend who I was with and I, we went to the airport. And the one thing we did have was our passports, because we had kind of locked them away in a safe. We went to the airport. We were trying to change our flights to just go home, because we had no way to continue our trip. And we did the American thing where we were like, can we talk to the manager? You know, and we had gone to the police. We had this police report. We were going to show them all the stuff. And they went and they got the manager, and the manager came. And they were just like, no, can't do anything about it. Sorry, you know, and left. But then the people at the front who were typing on the computer, they were like, let me see that. And they looked at the police report and they were like, you lost all these things. We don't want you to have this experience of Brazil. We're going to go ahead and change your tickets. And so we had this idea that the person with the power, the person with the authority, was like the manager, the person with the title. But in fact, that person who was sitting there, as you said, at the front desk, you know, they had the power to just make the change quickly. And I think you're right that is kind of figuring out the types of power that different people have in an organization is so critical. So there's the power that comes with authority, of course, but then there's the power that comes with information or just access to certain systems. There's the power that comes from interpersonal influence, right? If people who tend to be very likable, people who tend to be central in the social network, all those people have power as well. And kind of figuring out the type of power that different people have is definitely a key sort of point.
So as you're coming in as a new leader, and I think sometimes people have, and I've heard it described as the imposter syndrome, you feel like, you know, everybody in the room is smarter than you. They know they've got a handle on everything. And to realize sometimes the people that are in leader roles sometimes are, you know, they're frightened or scared about, you know, being accepted and all that that goes along with it. But there was a story that I think it was called the Spotlight Effect. And talk a little bit about that, how it relation to kind of, you know, things that we're really conscious of, you know, things that really we're uncomfortable about ourselves or whatever. But talk a little bit about that and kind of thoughts around what you learned through that.
Yeah, this is a finding that was actually conducted by a colleague of mine, Tom Gilovich. And it's this idea that when we are self-conscious about something, when we're worried that, you know, we've said something stupid in a meeting or that everyone's looking at us because we're dressed in a different way, we tend to think that all eyes are on us when in fact, people tend not to be paying attention to the things we're most self-conscious about. And they did this in a very clever way. They tested this idea by having participants come into the lab. And they gave them a Barry Manilow concert t-shirt. And it was meant to be this embarrassing article of clothing, you know, and now I feel like people would just think it was cool and hip. But back then they pre-tested it and it was an embarrassing t-shirt. Participants didn't want other people to see them wearing it. And they basically led these participants into a room with a bunch of other people. And then under this cover story, they were like, oh, you know what? We're actually not going to have you do this part of the study. Just come back out of the room. And then they asked all the people in the room, did you notice what was on that person's t-shirt? And they asked the person wearing the t-shirt, how many people in that room do you think noticed who was on your t-shirt? And what they found was that the participants wearing the t-shirt thought almost everybody would have noticed their t-shirt, right? Because they were acutely self-conscious about it. But in fact, most people didn't notice it. And so they call it the spotlight effect because when we're self-conscious about something, we think everyone's paying attention to that embarrassing thing when in fact it's not true, right? Mm-hmm. Most people are ignoring the embarrassing things and kind of just taking our general presence into account.
So when you're coming in to lead a group, you know, you've got, again, the ability to influence, but you talked about advice for leaders that using your influence, getting kind of a third party perspective of kind of figuring out, talk a little bit about that and kind of how to do that.
Yeah. So this is an interesting idea is that one of the things I talk about in the book is that we tend not to recognize the impact that we have on other people in various situations. And one of the reasons for that is if you just think about what it's like to be human, physically, right? We're always looking out at the world through our own two eyes. So what do we see? We see what other people are doing to impact the situation, you know, how other people are talking to each other, how other people are talking to us. And so we get the sense that, you know, anything that's going wrong in this situation is all those people out there. And what we don't see when we look out at the world through our own two eyes, of course, is ourselves and all the things we're doing, the behaviors, the things we're saying that other people are actually reacting to and that are also impacting that situation, right? Or that scenario. And so one of the things that research shows could help to sort of combat this just, you know, nature of being human and the way we see the world is to actively try to take a third party perspective. And you can do that in a few ways. So there's some research actually in couples showing that couples after their first year of marriage, they usually show this decrease in marital or relationship satisfaction. But if three times a year, really just three times a year for 7 minutes, they write about their interactions together. So a recent fight they had, for example, from a third party perspective, imagine that a friend of yours was watching you fight, right? All of a sudden, now they have this perspective on the way they contributed to the dynamics, not just what their spouse was doing. And they show that that actually prevents this decrease in marital satisfaction over time. And so similar things have been suggested by other researchers that if you can just do a little exercise by imagining yourself as a third party watching this situation with you in it, right? Mm-hmm. It helps you to sort of understand the ways that you are also contributing and the things you might be saying that are maybe harming a dynamic or people are reacting to.
Yeah. Great advice. I'll have to try that out personally, figure that out. Well, talk a little bit about, I think you mentioned this in the book that sometimes when leaders come in and they're the first ones to talk and share their ideas, what impact that has on a group that you're leading. You talk a little bit about that and just some thoughts and tips that you think would be helpful to a new leader.
Yeah, this is another place where we tend to underestimate the impact we have when we're the ones who speak first. And I think a lot of us, you know, as we make our way up sort of the leadership ladder, we often feel like we have to prove why we're in this new leadership position, right? We feel like, oh, I just got promoted. I'm coming in. I'm leading my team. They're all going to be wondering if I really deserve this position, right? And we tend to get very self-conscious about that. And often our reaction to that is to talk more, right? To try to prove that we're here because we all have all these great ideas. So we're going to, you know, spout out all those ideas so you guys all know why I'm here. When in fact, that can prevent other people from talking. And we tend to forget that when we are in that leadership position, you know, we come in with that authority and by default, people are looking to us, right? We don't need to prove why we're there. We don't need to get them to look at us and talk a bunch so that they will listen to us. We're already at that point when you're in that leadership position. And so you actually, that's exactly the kind of time when you want to take a step back and talk less, because if you're the first to speak, everyone else is not going to want to kind of go against the thing that you just said, and you're going to squash creative and new ideas or any kind of dissent in the group, as opposed to letting everybody else speak first and then kind of summarizing or giving your opinion. And I think that's something that is definitely a kind of new leader mistake, but lots of people do that as well, where they think they need to kind of just be the person who talks first.
So outside of work, what do you do to recharge?
Let's see. We do. So I'm in Ithaca. So we have, okay. Of course, we are sure. Gorges, as the Ithaca saying goes. So we do a lot of hiking around the gorges and the waterfalls. I'd say that's a major thing that we do. Mm.
So any books that you would recommend to leaders that have been helpful to you and that you would put on somebody's list?
Yeah, definitely. My graduate student buddy, Ethan Cross, wrote a book called Chatter. And it's a great book all about kind of dealing with the voice in our heads that can sometimes derail us from reaching our goals. And he's actually one of the people who has done research on this third-party perspective. And he shows that taking a perspective outside of your head can help you manage emotions and this kind of chatter that you have in your head that can be problematic. And then there's a new wonderful book by Zoe Chance called Influence is Your Superpower, which is definitely, it's already kind of a big hit, and I can definitely see why. It's kind of an update of a Dale Carnegie, Bob Cialdini kind of book, you know, a classic influence book, but for nice people, for influence that also maintains relationships. And it's a really fun read.
Yeah. Well, great. Well, I encourage everybody to pick up your book, and you have more influence than you think, and definitely appreciate you taking time to talk to us again. And how would somebody learn more about your work and how to connect with you?
Sure. You can go to my website, which is Vanessa Bohns, and Bohns is BOHNS.com. I'm also on Twitter at Prof Bohns and Instagram at Prof Bohns, and I'd love to connect with people there.
Great. Well, thanks again. I wish you continued success in all that you're doing.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.